I think this guy is a Marxist, but what he wrote about the history of the novel is quite useful. So there are basically two pillars of the class. I mean, one of them is the question of dialectics, the philosophy of Marxism, and then the changes in consciousness that are the prelude to the emergence of dialectics as they're reflected in literature. So Troy's been through a class on dialectics, but that probably wouldn't hurt to repeat it, and I don't think you have been yet. So.
I mean, I know a little bit about...
Right, okay, so just to go... I mean, the basic point of dialectics is it's a philosophy based on a concept of motion and change. And in that sense, I mean, it's not new in history. There were tendencies in that direction in ancient Greek philosophy. But they arose out of similar conditions. That is, where you get the rise of the concept of dialectics or dialectical materialism in ancient Greece. It's the period of the flourishing of trade in the Ionian Islands, where, you know, it leads to a concept of impermanence, of change, a dynamic view of reality as opposed to, the traditional religious philosophies of the Middle East that saw things as essentially unchanging. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, unchanging eternal realities and so forth. And it's summed up in this aphorism of one of the philosophers of that period, to panto surge, everything flows. So dialectics arises also in a period of rapid social and economic change at the beginning of the 19th century, but it's a culmination of processes that begin earlier. And its basic concept is that you have to look at everything in motion. You know, previous to dialectics, there's this concept of formal logic where A equals A and B equals B. Well, according to dialectics, A could never equal A exactly because A would always be changing. You know, it would be A1, A2, A3, A4. And then the things tend to, as they develop, they change into their opposite. They become different. And that reality develops through a conflict of forces. You know, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. That leads to a development of history that is more because the history develops in response to the relationship of countervailing forces, that it tends to develop as a upward spiral, rather than a linear pattern, or rather than being stable. Now, the elements to the rise of the dialectic, one would be the materialist side, that is the French materialists of the 18th century, Diderot, Voltaire, people like that, whose concept of materialism was mechanical. That is, that's the great age of mechanics, of clockwork. In fact, Louis XVI, who lost his head in the French Revolution, was an amateur clockmaker and locksmith. The French Revolution was in 1789, and that was in the reigning king at the time was Louis XVI, and I think he was executed maybe a year later. You know. As the revolution in France started as a revolution for a constitutional monarchy, as the model for the French Revolution was what existed in England. You know, the model for the French Revolution was the compromise in England that came out of the revolution, which was 1688. Basically, all during the 18th century, the liberal or radical French philosophers looked to England as a model. You know, and it's the peculiarity, speaking of the irregular movement of history. Throughout the 18th century, England is the model of progress, the revolutionary state. Then the French Revolution comes along in 1789, and England becomes the leader of the counter-revolutionary powers that are out to smash the French Revolution because it dared to cut off the sacred head of the king. You know, and it becomes the leading counter-revolutionary power. It was essentially the English in alliance with the Russians. That prevented the extension of the French Revolution, and it led to the overthrow of Napoleon, new order in Europe represented by the Council of Vienna that was essentially a reactionary order. So what happens in England in the 18th century? You know, there was a social revolution in England in the 17th century in 1640 that led to a period of very radical social developments. You know, it was the most extensive and the most deep-going social revolution in Europe before the modern times. The revolutionary period lasted for about 20 years. But it ended with a restoration of the monarchy, the restoration of the Stuart monarchy. And then the Stuart monarchy was overthrown in 1688 by William of Orange. And that establishes a compromise. That is, the Stuarts were identified with the principle of divine rule, you know, as the king was the representative of God on earth and all authority was vested in the king. So when the Stuarts were overthrown, the new monarchy shared power with the Parliament. And whereas the Stuart monarchy had been a sort of a hybrid of rule of the bourgeoisie and a very unstable hybrid of rule of the bourgeoisie and the feudal classes, by the time that William of Orange took over, it was a purely bourgeois state. Although there were vestiges, you know, that is, the old aristocracy was never eliminated as totally in England as it was in France, and the state continued to be, in principle, a monarchical state. You know, that is, that authority was vested in the king, but the king reigned and didn't rule. You know, and generally speaking, the king's powers were reduced all during the 19th century, and the electorate was steadily increased during the 19th century. The electorate in the 17th century and in the 18th century would have been extremely small. And it's toward the end of the 18th century, also the second half of the 18th century, that the Industrial Revolution begins. And the Industrial Revolution, beginning mainly in the production of cloth, the production of cotton, you know, around new innovations like the cotton gin, you know, that would spin cotton, and these machines that would weave cotton and so forth. So that became it becomes the basis of the factory system, you know, and also the steam engine, you know, and the beginning of transport that revolutionizes society. And the Industrial Revolution is essentially confined to England for about 100 years. Now, with the rise of a modern economy, the factory system, the capitalist system in England in the 18th century, it's reflected in the rise of a new school of economics, you know, the so-called English political economists like Adam Smith and Hume and others that Marx based his theories on. Now, the first philosopher to see history as evolution, that is to see a process of evolution in history, is Hegel. And that's his connection with Marx. Hegel is influenced by the English political economists and the French materialists, but he also adds an element of his own. That is, it was France that was convulsed by revolution in the 18th century, but being convulsed by revolution, although they were carrying out revolution in action, their thought tended to lag behind it. That is, they were preoccupied with deeds rather than thought. And in the case of Germany, which was affected by the French Revolution, that is, you know, the German princes were involved in the League to try and restore the monarchy in France, and therefore they were in a war with France, and they lost the war. Germany was occupied by France. And in particular, the western part of Germany was the law was reformed by Napoleon, which was, you know, adopted the Napoleonic Code. So Germany was very heavily affected by the French Revolution, but it wasn't convulsed by a revolutionary process. So the philosophers in Germany much more contemplated the effect of the French Revolution, what the meaning of the French Revolution was. And the leading one in that respect was Hegel, who came up with the concept of historical evolution. although Hegel's concept of historical evolution was the idea, was an evolution of ideas rather than material facts, you know. That's the famous statement that Marx turned Hegel on his head. That is, he took Hegel's concept of the evolution of society, but he saw the evolution of society as changes in the mode of production and the social forms that developed on the basis of the various modes of production rather than the evolution of ideas as such. It's from his concept, in Marxism, the ideas follow changes in reality. They don't precede it, you know. Well, they both follow and proceed, because one of the principles of dialectics is the interpenetration of cause and effect. So you see, you know, that is that the material changes in society change people's consciousness. And on the basis of their changed consciousness, they come up with new ideas. And then as they implement these ideas, they also act on the reality. They change the reality itself. So we'll go into a bit of that. Now, what's different about, you know, what if you talk about the rise of the modern world in the 18th century, that is, that's the beginning of democracy, it's the beginning of literacy, it's the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the factory system. It's also the beginning of the novel. The novel is essentially a new literary form that begins in this period, and it reflects the consciousness that arises because of these changes. You know, there were long prose works in history, but they're typically romances or picaresque novels that are different from the modern novel, and Watt explains why. That is, in these historical romances, there's no concept of time. That is, basically, they're, you know, rather than describing different states of fact, they describe eternal values. And the picaresque novels are products of social decay. I mean, that they developed in Spain as a result of the mass impoverishment that was caused by the influx of gold and silver from Latin America. It produced the paradox was that although all of this wealth flowed into Spain, it impoverished Spain because it produced an inflation that made goods very expensive. And since Spanish manufacturers weren't very developed, the money went essentially to England and Holland to import the things that the people who had money wanted, you know, and that the Spanish industry, such as it was destroyed, and then the old money, the old aristocracy was impoverished, and the picaresque novel describes the life of these impoverished gentry who then become basically wandering adventurers. But what the picaresque novels do is they describe a series of episodes that are vehicles for social satire, but the characters themselves are just conventions. That is, you don't get into the interior life of the characters at all. And picaresque novels are basically full of plot. There are always things happening, you know, but it's kind of a kaleidoscope of things happening, but with no investigation of interior life, of relationships between people, or of social change as such. And in medieval literature, the concept also is that the values are eternal. In fact, one of the big controversies in medieval philosophy was the controversy around so-called late medieval nominalism. Because the early medieval scholastic philosophers thought that the word for beauty was the same thing as beauty, you know. That is, beauty was an idea, and the word being an idea, it was invoked by the word, and therefore the word was the same thing. The nominalist said, it's not the same thing, it's just the name of it, you know. So it's like an early form of realism. But also there's no concept in early literature, there's no concept of the time. You know, if you take, say, the earliest writings like the Homeric poems, you know, there's no real attempt to reproduce the, you know, the, or to describe the material existence that in which the siege of Troy was supposed to take have taken place, because it was supposed to have taken place 500 or 600 years before Homer's poems were committed to writing, you know. But there was, you know, there's no investigation of the costumes, the attitudes of the period, you know, no concept of the specific time that the thing takes place. And in general, because of that, since it's eternal values that the, rather than the particular fact that literature reflects, there's no, you know, there's no concept of time. It's like classical drama is supposed to take place within a 24-hour period. You know, that's one of the unities of Aristotle. The play has to, the whole action of the play has to unfold within 24 hours. You know, and that's the principle of the French classical drama. You know, Corneille, Racine, and so forth, is that the whole action takes place within 24 hours. Well, you know, if it takes place within 24 hours, then there's no room for evolution. Time has no particular place. What you're just seeing is a playing out of the relationship between values. And then the other thing too, if time is unimportant, place is unimportant also. That is, if you read the medieval writings, there's no concept of different places. Every place is the same. You know, you read, let's take the great Italian epic poems of the Middle Ages, like Orlando Furioso of Ariosto. You know, that takes place all over Europe, supposedly, because the heroes are chased by the Moors all over Europe. But I mean, obviously the Moors didn't go all over Europe. You have no concept of the territory that the Moors actually conquered, or when these things took place, or what the differences were among the countries. Because all time is the same, all place is the same, and essentially all the plots are the same also. Because there's no attempt to develop an original plot. You know, basically of the older literature, the plots are taken from mythology, or from religious writings, basically from mythology, because it doesn't, it doesn't really matter. You're dealing with values and not fact. Now, what happens in this period, and it's reflected, he refers a lot to the philosophy of Locke. Locke, who was the great philosopher who came out of the English Democratic Revolutions, and who was the philosophical model, for example, of the American revolutionists. And Locke is the first one who comes up with the idea that the truth is particular. You know, that is, the truth is not universal and it's not eternal. The truth is particular. It's the result of a particular evolution. And so you, in the novels that follow this, you begin to get, one is that the novel takes place over a period of time. The characters evolve. The characters have memory. And since the characters change, that is, they're presented in different states throughout the novel, the way that they're unified is through the laws of motion, that is, through the pattern of development. Either they're not 20 different people, but 20 different states of the same person, where the different states are united by the laws of motion, which would be, you know, basically like the dialectical idea. Also, since there's this evolution and there's a specificity of time and place, the characters exist in a social environment, and you see the social environment. The social environment is described, and it's the social environment of a specific period, which is the result of social conditioning, and you see how the society works and how the person is inserted into it. And that produces a fundamentally different type of literature, a different type of consciousness. And also, you know, what's associated with it too is the development of individualism. You know, because like in the medieval, everybody is the same. The fate of mankind is decreed by God. God has made man. God has made man in his image. All men are essentially the same, although God assigns them to different stations in life. They're all essentially the same. But in the novel, since men are the result of specific, the characters are the results of specific conditions and linked to specific conditions, the characters themselves are specific and individual. They make individual choices. Now, this is related to, you know, the way Hegel saw consciousness developing. As in his philosophy of history, he says, like, the beginning of life is unvermittelte Vermittelbarkeit. Unvermittelte Unvermittelbarkeit. You know, that is unmediated immediacy. What he means by that is that there's just a flow of sensations, you know. There's no consciousness, there's no ordering of the flow of sensations. Creatures are essentially afloat in the flow of sensations. And then the next stage would be Vermittelte Unvermittelbarkeit, you know, where they're still in the flow of sensations, but there's some control over it, you know, some classification. It's not simply, you know, the blind flow of it. And then the final form would be Vermittelte Vermittelbarkeit, you know, that is mediated mediation, where essentially people live in society and they're conscious of it. So that the first stage of becoming conscious of society would be to become conscious of yourself. You know, and you become conscious of yourself because you have a range of choice. That is, you're no longer a serf, but you're a factory worker, and you're part of an economic system, you know, and part of a political entity. That is, there are the democratic revolutions, there's the different religious sects, and so forth. So that you get characters that are actually individuals. And he gives the example of Defoe's novel, Moll Flanders. Now, Defoe was the earliest of these writers. He wrote, I think he was born in 1860, or 1660, or maybe a bit before, but he wrote about, you know, his first writing is at the end of the 17th century. And Moll Flanders is similar to a picaresque novel. That is, the central character of it is a déclassé woman criminal who is bounced back and forth between England and the colonies and so forth. But that she has consciousness, you know. She has memory. Her actions are the result of previous actions. That is, there's causality. Because if you have, you have development over time, and you have memory, and you have the interpenetration of the present and the past, therefore you also have the concept of causality in the novel, which is another one of the characteristics of the novel. As the earlier literature doesn't have causality, it has coincidence. You know, like if you see these Italian farces and so forth, the whole story is built around a chain of very improbable coincidences, not really causality. But in the novel, there's causality. Because of that, the novel becomes like a form of imaginary history. You know, it's very similar to the writing of history. And it explains why, you know, what makes a novel work is how well it describes the problems that people face in dealing with reality. Because like in previous literature, the main quality of the writer was his style, you know, his technique, his use of the language, the ornateness of the language. But in the case of the novel, a lot of the leading novelists write badly, even illiterate, even ungrammatically. Dostoevsky writes a very poor Russian, for example. But he's still a great novelist because he deals with the burning problems of the 19th century, you know, with alienation, with with rebellion, with the moral problems of of opposing the status quo, with the problems of the decay of religion and things like that. But he's a great novelist, although he's a bad writer. And Watt makes the point that, in terms of style, both Richardson and Defoe are poor writers, particularly Defoe. Because Defoe, looking at the specific facts of his character's life, tends to be very matter-of-fact. You know, that is, he's not ornate, and the sentences are not necessarily well-constructed. I should say also that, you know, the rise of the novel comes at the same time as the rise of journalism. Now, the reading public in the 17th century was still very limited. And he estimates that it was about 80,000 people out of a total population of 6 million in England. But it was much more, it was much bigger than it had been in the previous period. You know? And that you get the emergence of journals that are very influential, you know, like the Tatler and the Spectator. But altogether, they have a circulation of about 44,000. But you do have in this period, a big expansion in readership relative to the previous period. Books are still very expensive. He says books in this period are about as expensive as they are today, but the incomes were one-tenth of what they are today. You know, that the price of buying the novel Tom Jones, for example, would support a working-class family for a week. So it was obviously we're not working-class people who bought it. But there is the beginning of an emergence of a middle layer that read. And also the emergence particularly of a feminine public. Because this is the period, as the bourgeoisie enriches themselves, that their wives don't have to work anymore. It's the principle of the rising bourgeoisie is that the wives are supposed to be just ornaments. And they don't actually work anymore. Whereas in the previous time, they would have had to manage the house and the children and work long hours. You know, in this period, they don't have anything to do because it reflects the status of their husband that they're not forced to work. You know, the husbands can afford to hire domestic help. And there's a huge increase in the number of domestic servants in this period. And the domestic servants are largely literate, and they form a very important part of the readership. Because they're living in a house where the conditions are that they're able to read. You know, I mean, working class houses of this period would be lit only by candles. They'd be overcrowded. It'd be very difficult to read. You know, if you're a servant in a big house, you probably have light, or you can read during the day. It's not so overcrowded. And the servants would follow the example of the master. You know, the mistress who would read. So Richardson's novel, his great novel, the first one that's known, Pamela, is written about a domestic servant. It's the whole saga of the attempt of a dissolute master to seduce his domestic servant, and her victory over him because she won't give up her treasure without being married. So it's very moralistic. I mean, his second novel, which is much longer, is called Clarissa. It's also a novel in letters. But in that case, Clarissa is a gentlewoman who is wronged by her lover. That is, he drugs her and he rapes her, and she considers herself dishonored, so she commits suicide. And it's a very long novel, and her death is extremely long. It's one of the longest deaths in literature. But he points out, you know, that the very form of the epistolary novel is a much closer approximation to reality, because you can follow the development of the characters through their dialogue, and it's limited in time. The letters have specific dates on them. You know, one letter precedes another. He gives the specific date, the specific time and day that Clarissa dies. You know, and they're also full of details of domestic life. They're not generalities, but they're full of the detail and the paraphernalia of domestic life. And, you know, there's also social judgments involved in the thing. That is, Richardson was a Puritan, and he viewed the aristocracy as dissolute. In other words, the aristocracy were the Cavaliers, the people who came back with James II, and the people who presided over the Restoration drama, which was, you know, the drama of the Restoration period that was notoriously licentious, you know, as opposed to the Puritan drama that preceded it. So he views corruption as essentially coming from the aristocracy, and that is opposed to the virtuous poor. And Fielding would be the most neoclassical of these three writers. He's also the latest of them. But Fielding's novels are, you know, they're large-scale novels in which his model is the, you know, like he needs a classical model, so he takes the model of the mock epic. His novels are essentially humorous, and the pattern is the mock epic. But what makes the point, his Fielding's style is much better than Richardson or Defoe. It's more ornate. But because of the fact that it's ornate, it's less realistic, because you get the feeling that the dialogues, as he reproduces them, couldn't really take place in nature, you know. But what you're getting is a refined report of the dialogues. It's not that you're eavesdropping on it. Whereas in the case of these letters, you're eavesdropping on the dialogue between, you know, between the characters. And in the case of Defoe, you see the way the character herself views her experiences. Now, if individualism, the liberation of the individual, was essential for the rise of the novel, it reflects the rise of the it's the first stage of the rise of the revolutionary period of the bourgeoisie. This is the period where the old values are overturned. You know, before that, the monarch was sacred. The greatest crime imaginable was the execution of the monarch, but there were a whole series of monarchs that were overthrown. And they were overthrown in the name of reason. And reason is essentially an individual attribute. Each person thinks for himself. You know, the rise of the revolutionary period. Now, what happens, after we talk about the revolution of 1848, the failure of the revolutions of 1848 as being a watershed in the history of bourgeois culture and in the history of bourgeois politics. Because in this early period, the bourgeoisie is not afraid of reason, and it's not afraid of individual choice. It's not afraid of people not following the laws or the values that have been laid down in the past. And that's because the working class is still weak. The factory system is not yet developed. Most of the shops are small. The workers work next to their bosses. There's a kind of a patriarchal relationship between the workers and the bosses. But by the time the revolution of 1848 came along, the factory system was already well developed. The working class was well developed and separate from the bourgeoisie and conscious of itself and conscious that its interests were different. So when the revolutions took place against the established order in 1848, they tended to become socialist revolutions. They tended to become working class revolutions, and they scared the bourgeoisie. And so the bourgeoisie retreated from rationalism into irrational theories of one kind or another, like economic determinism. Say that would be represented by positivism, where people can't consciously change history. History changes very slowly and in a linear way as a result of the advance of education and technology. You know, but revolution, it can't be changed by revolution. And then even more pessimistic, irrational theories like the theories of Schopenhauer. The theories of Schopenhauer that are at the center of Dostoevsky's counter-revolutionary novel, The Devils. You know, there's huge undigested chunks of Schopenhauer in that novel. So that's the consciousness of the end of, at the end of the 18th, at the end of the 19th century. But in this context, the liberation of the individual tends to take on more and more a different character. You know, that is, the characters still develop in novels. That's one of the features of novels. And there's an interpenetration of the present and the past. But the characters begin to become more and more isolated from their social environment. And more isolated from other people. So if you take a novel like Ulysses, that would represent this fragment, this development toward fragmentation. You know, I mean, Joyce had a very complicated structure for Ulysses that's supposed to hold it together. But nobody except the academic industry that studies Ulysses understands what's supposed to unify Ulysses. And Ulysses is basically a series of anecdotes and conversations, pub talk. And the time is compressed because the whole of Ulysses, which is a huge book, 800 pages at least, is supposed to take place within 24 hours. It's one day in the life of Leon Bloom, you know, who was an isolated individual, the fact of being a Jew in Ireland, you know, and Joyce chose him for that reason, making him, the common man, but an unusual common man, not representative of common men in general, you know, in every way, in some ways yes, in other ways no. And it would go up to, finally, the existentialist novel where no connection between the characters is possible. That is, the idea of existentialism is that everyone is so unique that they're totally isolated from each other. You can never know the other, you know. And in that sense, also, that consciousness, the correctness of ideas doesn't really matter. From the standpoint of Sartre, the basic thing was choice. You have to commit yourself. You make a choice. You're free as an individual because you have the right. You have the ability to make a choice. That defines your right. Your freedom as an individual. And from that, he drew the conclusion that the most freedom existed in the concentration camp. Because in the concentration camp, you could make choices, and your choices had effects. You know, that is, you defied the guards, they beat you. Or they starved you, so it had an effect. You know? You could say that you had the right of choice, and your choice had an effect. Well, you know, I mean, that's not freedom as we would understand it. You know, there's the free development of the individual, that develop his potential, you know, to contribute to society. This is the individual, suicidal choice of an individual to assert his freedom at the expense of suicide. And then there's also this idea that, it's impossible to know the other. You can't, you know, you may fall in love with somebody, you may live with somebody, but you can't really, you can never really know that person. Everybody is condemned essentially to isolation. So it's like, the freeing up of the, or the freeing of the individual turning into its opposite, and it's reflected in the novel as it's reflected in modern society. That is, the freedom of the individual is the atomization of individuals, alienation of individuals in this society, the powerlessness of individuals, their powerlessness to change society, you know, their powerlessness to change their fate. That they become simply the pawns of historical processes that they don't understand, and that would be reflected in the naturalist novel at the end of the 19th century. You know, Zola talks a lot about the evils of capitalist society, but the reverse side of it is that his characters are not conscious of the evils of capitalist society. They're just conscious that they're oppressed. And he also has this idea that the characters are the result of their heredity. You know, one of his most famous novels, Nana, is about a prostitute and who corrupts the people that she comes in contact with. But he sees her corruption as being a result of her heredity. And he describes her as a golden fly that arises from the dung heaps of society to infect the better neighborhoods, you know. So, in it, you know, it would be linked also to racism, you know. Since the problems of are the result of heredity, so it's like the bourgeois revolution and bourgeois culture coming to a dead end. This individualism coming to a dead end. But what's inherent also in the novel is it has to describe, you know, there has to be some reason people read the novel. You know, you can talk about art for art's sake or the importance of technique, or it doesn't matter what the ideas are and what they are. But there has to be some reason that people read the novel. There are only a few people who would read novels for the sake of technique, you know, or for the sake of the language. Basically, they read them because the novel appears to be relevant to their lives and the problems that they face. And the result of that means that despite the pressure of bourgeois ideology to make novels unpolitical and to emphasize the isolation of individuals and the uniqueness of the different characters, there is a very strong force that forces novelists to become social critics. You know, and the great novelists of the 20th century are largely people who wrote about politics and who were social critics, you know, like Malraux, like Hemingway, like Dreiser, like Dos Passos in his early phase, you know. And what that means is that for the bourgeoisie, literature is dangerous. You know, they have a whole industry that tries to downplay any connection between literature and social criticism. But fundamentally, it's something that can't be stamped out. And so the solution is to try and stamp out literature. And you can see it in your own education. You know, that is that since the 1960s, they haven't taught the history of literature in high school anymore. They basically, most people, they just give people a few readings that would essentially give people some concept of technique, you know, of the style of writers, but not the context in which these works were produced. And also with this, the feeling of alienation and helplessness, particularly following the collapse of the Soviet bloc, you also get a collapse of readership. You know, I noticed it when I was traveling in Eastern Europe, because Eastern Europe, historically, in Russia and Eastern Europe, there's been a strong connection between radical politics and literature. You know? Most writers were radicals, and most radicals read, but nobody reads anymore. You know, people who read before the fall of the regime no longer read, because they no longer have any confidence that they can understand what's happening around them, much less change it. So, you know, it's, I think, a problem of the revolution to try and restore that faith, and in restoring it, we also restore the basis for literature. Because it is characteristic of our time that by far the most interesting writing is done in Latin America. I mean, Latin America is still the one area where you have great novelists who are literally impressive and who are read. I mean, I couldn't name one person in the United States or in Europe in that category, you know. And someone like Argatis or like Sabato or like a whole host of modern writers in Latin America. You know, that is the basic focus of literature is Latin America, but that's also where the focus of the world revolution is. That's where there are mass uprisings. That's where, you know, there's a mass revolt against neoliberalism, where people are gaining some confidence that they can change their fate, and that their fate is linked to the fate of their fellows. You know, it's not they don't look for individual solutions, say the way people do in the United States. In the United States, everybody is unhappy, but they're all looking for individual solutions to the extent that they're looking for solutions at all. So anyway, that's the basic outlines of it. So what do people think?
That was a really good class, Jerry. You really hit the nail on the head when you said that since the 1960s, which is, uh, or I was in high school in between 1992 and 1996, and even in college, you know, didn't learn much history of literature or anything, you know. I read a lot of good stuff, but there wasn't any sort of, it wasn't rooted in anything, you know. The continuity of why we would read one thing or another wasn't described to us or what it really represented. We were just looking for symbolism and things like that, which was sort of abstract because, you know, we didn't understand where these ideas were coming from in the first place. But the one question, well, at least one of the questions I have is, can you explain why in medieval literature they, I mean, as far as the consciousness of medieval life and in the different, you know, layers of society, why the literature wouldn't talk about time and place and things like that?
Well, because it was a very stratified society and it changed very slowly, you know. It was basically a society that was still rural, and where the you know, the rural people were subordinate not just economically but socially to the landowner. You know, they were basically the property of the landowner, and the there was an alliance between the church and the monarchy, and the church defined the monarchy as the reflection of God on earth. And that society, that they would make the analogy between society and the body, you know. That is, that the head of the society was the church, the people who prayed for the society. And then the arms were the military caste, who were also the landowners. And the feet were the peasants, you know. So you, obviously you couldn't raise the feet above the head, could you, or even above the arms. So, you know, it's essentially an extremely static society. That had a static form of consciousness associated with it. I mean, there are changes within that also. I mean, no society is totally static. There was a rebellion in the 12th and 13th centuries within the church, you know, where the, you know, the church schools expanded beyond the ability of the church to provide jobs for the people who were educated in the church schools, you know. And so a lot of the people who were educated didn't have regular employment and became basically wandering minstrels or adventurers, you know. And you get this rise of sort of licentious Latin poetry, you know, poetry that's irreverent both to the authorities and the sexual mores and so forth. But that was crushed by the 14th century. There was a counter-revolution against it. It was crushed, you know. And then that critical element re-emerges in the Reformation movements, you know, and then in the revolutions of the 16th and 17th centuries. But it's a slow process, you know. What I'm talking about is the end of it, mm-hmm. you know, where the actual consciousness changes. But as I say, the herald of this change in consciousness is Locke, who was the philosopher of the 17th century English Revolution. I mean, it would also be true in China, you know. I mean, in the great Chinese literary works, there's also, you know, like you read the Dream of the Red Chamber or was the Monkey King, you know, these novels. They don't have any sense of time and place, but they are they're a product of a process that was similar to what happened in Europe in the 12th and 13th centuries. That is, they were people who were educated but didn't pass their exams to get into the imperial bureaucracy. And therefore, you know, they had to go to the people to make a living. And they wrote these novels for, you know, a readership that was limited, but it was still a lot broader than the readership for classical poetry. In fact, there's a point, I started reading a history of Mexican poetry in which he says, you know, you get Mexican novelists like Lizardi, who is very critical of society and an important novelist and an innovating novelist, you know, at the beginning of the 18th century. But then the poetry of the period of the revolution is so stereotyped, it's so neoclassical, you know, completely based on European models. Well, how do you explain it? And he says, well, you know, the readership for novels was much broader than the readership for poetry, as poetry was regarded as a luxury, it was an ornament, and therefore there was less pressure to bring it in, into line with the feelings of people, you know, with the dilemmas that people felt. There are radical, you know, like Mailer, Norman Mailer would be one of the great names in modern American literature, who was radical at the beginning. I mean, his first book, The Naked and the Dead, is a radical book. In fact, the Soviet literary historians refer to Mailer as a Trotskyist. I don't know how much reality there is to it, but it must reflect something.
Can you elaborate on this point about Sartre being saying that freedom, the ultimate freedom, was in a concentration camp? Is that what somebody said?
Well, that's an aphorism that sums up his point of view. You know, that that this isolation of individuals, and given the isolation of individuals, you can't combine to consciously change your fate. And so your political positions are a personal choice, made essentially for personal and moral reasons. So it's not that that your ideas are correct, but that you commit yourself. You know, I mean, you have to make a choice, and you have to commit yourself for moral reasons. But it doesn't matter if what you commit yourself to is wrong. Sartre's concept was what we call a Stalinoid. You know, that is somebody who supported the Communist Party without believing in the Communist Party ideology. Because his line was, what the Stalinists say is nonsense, but the workers believe it. And therefore you have to respect the workers and pay lip service to the official Stalinist line. I mean, toward the end of his career, he became more critical of the Stalinist line. He identified more with the far left. But for most of his career as a writer, that was his outlook. You see, you know, it makes sense if you say it's a moral choice, you know, because in that sense, its objective result doesn't really matter. You made a moral choice. You align yourself with the weak. You align yourself with the oppressed. Therefore, you're home free. You know, I mean, the fact that you align yourself with the false leaders, with the misleaders of the working class, with their mythology, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's a completely subjective choice.
I don't know how much this has to do with the talk, but I know that Sartre would call the Saint Genet, or is that how you say it? Jean Genet?
Saint Genet, yeah. Saint Genet. It would be Saint Genet.
Okay.
In the French. Yeah, but I mean, there again, it's a personal choice, because he admired Genet as a rebel. Genet was a homosexual and a thief, and he was someone who gloried in his degradation.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, Sartre viewed him as a saint, a martyr. Because he mortified himself. You know? I mean, the truth of Genet is much more complicated than that. He wasn't really so bad off. He came from a relatively well-to-do family. And he never had it that hard, but he's extremely self-pitying. You know, I mean, his stuff is so self-pitying, I find it almost impossible to read. But it's symptomatic that Genet was a hero of the liberal and radical intelligentsia in France for a long time. And to a certain extent here also. You know, all of his work has been translated.
Yeah. Who was Voltaire?
Well, Voltaire was a philosopher and writer of the early 18th century. One of the most typical representatives of what we call the Enlightenment. You know, the Enlightenment is... this idea that you can change society through enlightened rule by educating the rulers. Because Voltaire was a friend of Frederick the Great. Frederick the Great in Prussia was his patron, you know. But he was also radical in the sense that he poked fun at the church doctrine, and you know, he glorified reason and so forth. So he's one of the sources of the French Revolution. Although he's one of the sources of the French Revolution in the sense, essentially, of being a critique of the ideology of the old regime, rather than being any kind of a revolutionist, because he had nothing to do with revolutionary organization or with revolutionaries. He hobnobbed with the rulers of his time. And he was, you know, he had a philosophical outlook, but he's essentially a writer of social satires.
I'd like to know some, maybe you could just give me some names of some of the Latin American writers right now who are really interesting.
Well, you know, there's Isabel Allende. Sabato. Galvez in Argentina.
Galvez.
You know, Lescano in Chile. They're not, you know, that. But Argatis is a modern writer. He died at the end of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a class on Argatis in particular because he was a friend of Hugo Blanco, was the leading Peruvian Trotskyist, the leader of the peasant struggle in Peru.
What's his name again?
Hugo Blanco.
Can you spell it for me?
Blanco? B-A-L-A-N-C-O. Mm-hmm. The Spanish word for white. And the writer is Jose Maria Argatis, and it's A-R-G-U-E-D-A-S.
And it's hard to find his stuff.
Well, it's not so hard to find the one novel, Los Rios Profundos, The Deep Rivers. Because that, you know, what's hard to find is Todas las Sangres, all the bloods. As Todas las Sangres is his most political and his most ambitious novel, and for that reason, you know, it's much less popular. You know,
mm-hmm.
The thing about Los Rios Profundos, although it has revolutionary chapters in it, is that it's written from the consciousness of a young teenager, and so you don't know what's real and what isn't. You know, it's the way young teenagers think. You know, there's no clear division between their dreams and reality.
Okay.
You know, and the one revolutionary scene is when there's a peasant uprising. It's in response to a cholera epidemic where the peasants demand that the priests come into their area to say the mass. You know, so that sort of covers it from a revolutionary point of view, although he gives a description of a revolutionary uprising. You know, in the case of Todas las Sangres, the main hero was an Indian revolutionary. You know, and it's revolutionary for real, you know, an aggressive form of revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also, you know, this is going back a bit further, but there's the novel of the Mexican Revolution. There's a whole school of novels about the Mexican Revolution. I think the best writer about the Mexican Revolution is Azuela, A-Z-U-E-L-A. And Azuela is a critic of the Mexican Revolution. He saw it as a revolution that was betrayed. And his most famous work is called Los de Abajo, The Underdogs, where he describes, you know, the peasants rise up and they win, and then they're betrayed and they're on the bottom again, you know.
How were they betrayed?
Well, I forget the exact, you know, what it is the old landowners sort of get together with the new regime and then they suppress them. That's what happened in the case of Mexico, you know. That is, you know, when Madero began the revolution on a limited political basis, but then it led to a social revolution. And that led to the emergence of two revolutionary armies, the army of Pancho Villa in the north and the army of Zapata in the south. And the new regime, headed up by Obregón, who was one of the military commanders, you know, in the Civil War, crushed the army of Zapata and they crushed the army of Villa. and defeated the social revolution. So that basically the society, you know, the condition of the peasantry who supported Zapata and supported Villa didn't change. You know, they continued to be oppressed, they continued to be exploited.